AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet, Chevy runs deep.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 142 for March 23rd. Turn it up to 12. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Hey, it's Thursday, and great having everybody here with us once again for AutoLine After Hours. Unfortunately, my co-pilot, my co-host of the show, who's always here, Peter DeLorenzo, is not able to make it tonight. So we're going to miss the auto extremist. However, you'll get a good dosage of him next week, because next week I cannot be here and Peter's going to host the show. So even though he's not here tonight, you'll get plenty of him next week. And also joining us tonight is Gary Vasilash from Automotive Design and Production Magazine. Great having you here, Gary.
Thank you, John.
We'll talk automotive design and production, I'm sure, at some point. And we got Frank Marcus joining us from Motor Trend Magazine. Great having you here, too.
Just in out of the rain.
Just in, yeah. We got a raging storm outside, so I'm glad that you were able to thread your way through the traffic and make it here.
Yeah.
And as we mentioned, too, we'll have Pietro Gorlier from Mopar joining us later in the show, too. We'll talk all things Mopar at that point. But we do have to sort of pick up from where we left off in last week's show, because last week we had Bryce Hoffman here, the Detroit News journalist who has written a book all about Ford called American Icon, and Random House, his publisher, graciously gave us five copies to give away. And so we had a contest to see who could figure out what Alan Mulally's middle name is. And if you got that right, we picked from all the correct answers five names out of who got it right. So I'll put you guys on the spot.
I have no idea.
Can I Google it real quick?
Yeah. Well, it's a bit tricky.
What's the initial?
I'll give you. It's R. Nah, you'll never get it. You'll never get
Randall.
It.
Randall.
No. It's an easy name. But it's funny because if you go and Google it, because I had to do it too, Frank, even though I came up with the question, I didn't know the answer. And the first thing you hit on is a Alan David Mulally. So we actually had one guy say, oh, his name's David. Well, no, this is just some guy on LinkedIn or rather. He's not our Alan Mulally. So Alan Mulally's...
Two less zeros on his salary, probably.
Yeah, a few less zeros, that's right. But anyway, Roger... It's Alan Roger Mulally. And, you know, you guys know Mulally. I think he's more of a Roger than he is an Alan. Anyway, so at random, I picked out of, and we had a lot of entries. There was a lot of interest in getting this. So the lucky winners are, and I know I'm going to butcher the names, but anyway, Brian Earn, that's E-R-N-E, Louis Alcala, Anthony Alanese, I hope I said that right, Randy Seck and Slandy. That's how he signed it. We don't have their addresses. We'll have to get it. But you guys are the five lucky winners of American Icon.
It would have been funny if Alan David had won.
Yeah, right. Or watch, we'll get a call from Mulally and say, my name is David. Yeah, Wikipedia's got it wrong. So lots going on, as they're always in this business. But, Frank, I'm dying to ask you, what do you make of this Camaro ZL1 being delayed for quality problems?
Serious bummer, man. The world is
cool
really
car,
dying to get their teeth on that thing. We had a lot of fun with one out west. Unfortunately, I wasn't in the driver's seat on that one, but real good stuff, you know. In fact, our cover blurb was, you know, ZL1 tells boss to shove it or something like that. So, yeah.
Gary, you haven't heard what these quality problems are.
No, but I'm beginning to think that it's probably more software than anything. I mean, don't you get the sense that would be an issue to be able to, you know, bring these things back, maybe make some adjustments, you know, that way rather than, I mean, because, come on, you know that in terms of engine, powertrain manufacturing, those guys do a great job. So, I mean, What's it going to be?
Or is it a supplier issue? I mean, you got to think, what's different from the regular Camaro? Because they've been building the regular Camaro for a couple of years now, so you would think that's not the problem, or all Camaros would be shut down. It's only the ZL1. The big thing is the powertrain, right? And the suspension. But the suspension is that rheological stuff that they've been doing for a while. But I got to believe, maybe you're on to something. Maybe it is a software
problem. I'm with Gary. I would imagine that it's always the integration of all that stuff. Yeah, we've had, you know, magnetic rheological shocks. Yeah, we've had, you know, the supercharged engines. We haven't had it in this car, in this architecture, in this CAN bus, et cetera. And there's probably some ones and zeros that aren't getting along in there somewhere.
Yeah, I don't think it's the classic problem of, you know, the stamping was bad or the orange peel of paint or, you know, things.
Didn't have to go back and redo the tooling or anything.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to be it at all.
But they say the production will be delayed weeks, not months. So that would suggest more to your talk that, you know, they just have to do a few keystrokes and get these things going.
Yeah, if we're correct, then what that probably means is that they've recognized a problem and they haven't figured out how to solve it yet. And they've got all their best, you know, computer engineers hacking away at it. And it could be days, but we're not going to promise that.
So. Right.
And you got to believe, too, you know, if they're going to limit production of the 2012 model, that it's only going to drive up the value of those things.
Right. There'll be a few of those, and they'll have the 2013s, and then they'll be well on their way. Because, you know, every one of those is going to be sold. I mean, it...
Yeah, what are they planning on building? Do you know the number of them?
I haven't been clear on that.
Mm.
Yeah, it's going to be low production for sure with the price of that thing.
And no one likes to predict those things and then miss.
No, because then we in the media excoriate them when they don't get it right. So... what else has been going on in the news here?
Well, you think another issue that is clearly related to software is that whole Fisker problem that Consumer Reports has had.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you read some of the complaints that other people have, and, I mean, it's all software. I mean, and so you say to yourself, you know that the electric motor is probably fine. You know it's an Ecotec engine. That's fine.
Have you driven one of those things?
No, I haven't.
I mean, everything in it is new, except like some switches that you can recognize from GM stuff and whatever. All of the displays, everything, and it's different. And you think, wow, you're really going to take on all of that stuff? You know, and I don't know. Personally, I will be gobsmacked if 1,000 of those things ever get made. I mean, probably 500 would stretch my imagination. And, you know, this most recent thing with Lasorda taking over at the top there is kind of interesting, too, because he's kind of fused to the 5-Hour Energy dude who's right here in Farmington Hills.
That high caffeine drink that's selling like crazy.
And it's constantly in litigation. He's got, I don't know how many... that he's plaintiff and that he's defended on. And so he doesn't keep money in that company that can be sued away. He invested. He's like a VC dude, you know, although not kind of as overt as, you know, some of them. And so Lasorda is one of his pals. And so you have to kind of wonder, is that why Lasorda got put in here now that we've got some other government money that's kind of been...
Not going to happen.
Not going to happen.
Well, in fact, the report said that Lasorda invested money in Fisker, and I thought, wow, that's a dangerous move.
He probably put some in, but he brought his pal.
The five-hour energy.
Bigger money, I think. Right. Yeah.
So you don't see that they brought Lasorda in for his knowledge of process and.
Oh, hey, that's super icing on the cake. But I think the point is, we got to have money. We're trying to drive, you know, run a billions of dollars business with hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars and. Right. You know, I mean, it doesn't at some point they just go, oh, game over, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, look how many electric car companies are going belly up right now because their whole business plan was predicated on getting government money. And so, you know, Bright Automotive, Aptera, Fisker probably too, and I know I'm missing a few others, and the rumors are out there that there's a couple of others.
Right, and meanwhile, this new study just comes out that says, yeah, gas needs to be like $12 a gallon for those to really make a lot of sense.
Do you believe that? Because I just got an email I haven't had a chance to go through from one of our viewers who's pretty smart on this stuff going, I don't buy that at all. $12.50 a gallon, that doesn't make sense.
Well, and that is considering the current state of the art. And, of course, Envia just made that announcement of doubling the range at half the price. Now, they haven't got the longevity quite nailed down, but they're pretty confident that 2 to 3 years they can have a maybe 300-mile battery at not much extra cost, at which point the pool of folks that can drive a car 300 miles is a lot bigger than folks that'll be happy with 170 in a Leaf.
I'll believe it when I see it, and I don't doubt that it's coming, but I'll believe it when I see it.
I've talked to a lot of the engineers in there, and you know, I'm not an electrochemical engineer, but what they were saying, it did sound like, hey, we found a secret, sauce here that has changed the game a little bit, so we'll see. And then there's lithium air kind of in the wings, 8 years to 10 years out, but they are also looking at 3 years to be into the electronics, small electronics space, which is like the first step, and then, when you get, I don't know.
I got to wonder if Fisker will ever open his plant in, is it Delaware?
Wilmington.
Isn't it? Wilmington, Delaware, right. I mean, if they're already running into problems with the karma, I just don't see the next generation coming down the pike.
But they're supposed to have a Nina reveal in New York at the New York show.
Yes, they are. Yeah. But, it's easy to build a one-off concept car and show it to the media. It doesn't even have to be a runner. And that's not that hard to do. The hard thing is crank up the assembly line, start running them down the line, and have people buying them.
And also having the people happy with them.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's going to be a big challenge for these guys.
Right.
Well, the other thing is the weight of this car. I just don't understand.
It's insane.
It's 5,400 pounds,
right.
I think. How does it get that heavy? I mean, the Volt and the Leaf are nowhere near that.
Well, yeah, it's got a fairly big battery and, a fairly robust engine and wheels this big. And not only that, it's huge and it's tiny inside. I mean, you don't want to ride anywhere in the back seat of that gigantic car.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, yeah.
Yeah, well, Consumer Reports, beside the thing breaking down on them, once they got it fixed and running, they weren't very impressed by the car.
It's a disingenuous car. I mean, these people are going to roll up to the red carpet in Hollywood in this thing silently and go, look at me saving the earth with my electric car. And when you drive this car, if you put it in that mode, that totally eco mode, it's a slug. It is really slow. So, the minute they're out of range of the cameras, they're going back to the sport mode, which is the bare minimum get around mode. And it's like 20 miles per gallon tippity tops in that mode, I think, real world.
That's one of the things that we covered in Autoline Daily today was, or yesterday, how many car companies are not hitting their targets. So Fisker said, we're going to get 100 miles per gallon equivalent, and the EPA goes, no, it's really about half that.
Yeah, was it 56, I think?
I thought it was around 50, but I don't know what the actual, but whatever, it was way below what
Fisker
was.
Yeah, it's not 100.
And then BMW just got whacked on the new 3 Series. They said that it was going to get 36 miles per gallon in the EPA on the highway, and the EPA goes, nah, it's about 3 miles per gallon under that. Frank, you were an engineer. You did. How come these car companies, and it wasn't just that either. There's been others who have been whacked of late. Why are they not getting these numbers?
I know. It really is a mystery because the FTP 75 is not a mysterious cycle. It's very hard to imagine how they would miss it on their tests. I mean, obviously, there's nothing in it for them to advertise a big number or claim a big number in all the preview things, and then the real thing comes out and you've got egg on your face. So I'm not exactly sure what it is. And, back in the day, there was a time where most of us kind of presumed that the GMs of the world had figured out how to kind of teach the car that, hey, if you see the gas pedal do this and then do that and then do the other thing, you're on FTP 75 and now go to the super hyper mile, mode, whereas the BMWs of the world just build a car the way they wanted it and send it to EPA and so just run it down there and see what happens. And so as a result, the BMWs would real world make their number closer than the GMs because nobody ever drove that exact same way to get the computer to go,
Right, and so it gets back to this whole thing. It was probably an ECM problem, right? And it comes back to software.
Maybe. I mean, it's possible.
I don't know because, there is FTP 75 that everybody's got to drive. But then there's what I call the fudge factors. And I don't know if these guys just didn't get that right. Or
they were counting on a little bit because there's all these other little things that twist the knob, too. If you do other things that are good for CO2 that don't show up on the FTP 75, they give you little credits and maybe some of those got figured the wrong way. I don't know. I haven't had a chance to dig into it, but it is strange.
I thought, and especially for BMW, to miss it. I guess they can still claim best-in-class fuel economy. But,
and it's a dynamite car. No one will miss that old six-cylinder non-turbo for driving this thing. I mean, it really is super nice riding car for, you know, the entry-level BMW.
Right.
What else? What else have you guys been interested in or doing or driving? Or what's caught your attention of late?
You know, I'm driving this, our long-term Motor Trend Car of the Year, Passat TDI. And it's amazing to me that almost, if I get on the highway at all on a trip, I can get the trip, the individual trip mileage up to over 40 miles per gallon. Now, granted, we've been told by a lot of industry insiders that those happy numbers on the computer are sometimes a little rosy, you know, granted. But still, that's a big car, you know, for getting anywhere near that, you know. So I'm kind of liking that.
Mm-hmm. And those people in Chattanooga must be happy with the announcement today of 800 more jobs being added.
They can't build them fast enough. They have to add more jobs.
800,000 cars, here we come.
That's their goal for the U.S. market, right?
Which we said was nutty when they started out, but
yeah, those guys don't take no for an answer.
Uh-uh.
Gary, you been driving anything or the like that really stands out in your mind?
Well, last week I was on a program driving the refreshed Flex.
Ford Flex,
Ford Flex, and the refreshed Taurus.
What'd you think of the Taurus?
I've always sort of liked that car. I mean, I don't know why, but you know, it just seems like a nice, sensible, sort of family car.
It hasn't sold all that well.
No, and it hasn't.
I mean, not that it sold poorly, but it's never hit the numbers they were hoping for.
It's a really big car.
Right, I think that
and
people,
it's kind of pricey.
The Fusion is probably where people end up going rather than the Taurus, and they see that. And you know, all-wheel drive, interesting car.
Flex is another one that's never really sold all that well.
It's sort of an anomaly, though, because, you know, if you think about it, what directly competes with the Flex?
I mean, and apparently it sells people who don't want to be associated with it being a Ford because they've taken all the Ford badges and shrunk them down and removed them.
Yes, well, they pulled the blue oval off the nose of the car,
right.
That's for sure.
They put the letters on there that look kind of like Range Rover lettering.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
If someone gets confused, I guess they won't be. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
But, you know, it worked for me because the first time I saw the Flex with the lettering on the leading edge of the hood there, my thought went right to Range Rover, and it was like, geez, really? Is that all it takes to fool me?
Yeah. I tell you, it was a bad week to be in Michigan and not in the L.A. office because we had the new McLaren out there.
Oh.
And that thing blew everybody away. Just some really cool technology on that thing. We can't wait to put it up against the 458 because obviously that was the, you know, the car on the crosshairs for that car. But neat suspension stuff, you know, all this interconnected, you know, shock absorbers and the no anti-roll bar thing. We're using that. And then they've got a Z-bar in the back, you know, which is there to counteract aerodynamic downforce. You know, so it doesn't do anything when the car is just rolling and whatever. But if both, you know, if the body tries to push down on both wheels, it resists that, you know. Very cool stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
What I find interesting about the McLaren is when you first look at it, it looks kind of plain. So not like the Ferrari, you know, which is just sex on wheels.
Right.
But when you look more closely at the McLaren, really start to go through it, you start picking up on very subtle styling cues and the like. It's a much more sophisticated car than it looks like at first glance.
Yeah. And, of course, the thing that I'm dying to know is, you know, they'll tell you that the 12 in that name has to do with some performance parameter. They boil down a whole bunch of stuff about cars, and they reckon that thing's a 12, you know? And we would love to know what that formula is and, you know, apply it to a bunch of other cars, but...
Yeah, I think that was, you know, a bunch of guys back in England smoking cigarettes and saying, hey, let's really pull one over on the media. We'll tell them it's a formula.
Maybe.
We'll tell them this really means something. So.
Or it's turning it up past 11.
Yeah. This one goes to 12.
They also haven't announced what the F1, the old McLaren, what the number was on that one.
Interesting.
How far away this one is from it.
Yeah. Well, hey, look, it's that time of the program. We really got to get our guest on here, Pietro Gorlier from Mopar. But we've also got to take a commercial break right now. So, Ben, let's give a shout-out and a good thanks to our friends at Bridgestone for sponsoring this show. Well, Pietro Gorlier, thanks so much for joining us here on Autoline After Hours. You've been flying all over the world, so it's great to have you in our studios here.
Thank you for inviting me. Great pleasure being here.
And we got so much to talk about with Mopar, and we've got a Mopar 12 in the studio here, and I want to get to that in a minute. But First, bring us up to speed on Mopar. Here you come in when, you know, Fiat buys Chrysler or takes over Chrysler, and you've got this brand here called Mopar. And take the story from there. What did Sergio Marchionne say? Hey, Pietro, get over here. I got something that you got to work on.
Well, but it didn't go really like that. I came here for, as I already told you, for a 2 days trip. And then he just called me and said, by the way, you get Mopar. And so I have to call home and tell my family, what do you think about moving in the U.S.? Fine. When? I'm staying here, so better to join me.
So here you are, this Italian executive who comes to the United States. Had you ever even heard of Mopar before?
Not really, to be totally honest. I started learning about Mopar while Chrysler and Fiat started talking together about the partnership. And has been a sort of a surprise every day. I mean, the level of passion and the number of followers that we have, not only in the U.S. I mean, we just reached the mark of 190,000 Facebook followers. And almost 20% are from outside the U.S., so it's a pretty global Mopar family.
So what does Mopar signify to these people? Why are they so
well? Definitely performance and customization. I mean, I met a couple of weeks ago in during Autorama the head of a Mopar club in Finland.
In Finland.
At Geneva, I had meetings with Mopar Club from Denmark. They all have the same kind of DNA that you find in a Mopar fan. So they want a unique car. They want to customize their cars. They want a performance, but not only performance, appearance. I would say that is really customization and driving a car that is representing your personality. That is, I would say, is the thread, the fil rouge that I find across all the Mopar fans around the world.
You know, my knowledge of Mopar going back to being a kid is seeing dragsters, you know, Chrysler product dragsters that said Mopar on the side. But you're doing a whole lot more than just building parts for performance cars, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look, and 2012 is a very big year for Mopar because we celebrate our 75th anniversary. You know, the Mopar brand was trademarked in 1937. And when you look at these 75 years, you can clearly see three different periods. At the beginning, simple contraction of motor parts, so was the brand for parts for the Chrysler Corporation. Actually, I mean, the first trademark was for an antifreeze product. Interesting enough. So then you get to the 60s, so muscle cars, performance. I think there is a sort of marriage in 1962 when the Hemi is launched. And then is obviously the 20 years of muscle cars, performance. And so everyone moves from using the brand for parts to using the brand to characterize the performance cars of the corporation. Then you get into the 80s, so where you still keep that DNA, but then you start entering more in the service and the after-sales business, because I think is when the industry started changing. It was not just important to have parts, but you need to have a distribution system. You need to take care of cars that are becoming more complicated. So the do-it-yourself is replaced by a lot of do-form me. And so then you have a lot of things in terms of service, supply chain. I mean, not very known, but Mopar was the first one to start delivering parts directly to the dealers without distributors in the 80s. So a number of progress. And these are the 75 years. Now we have at least another 75 years and beyond to build the future. And the future is still about customization. It's about customer service, but it's still a lot about customization of the cars.
So what I find fascinating is you're actually doing Mopar cars, not just parts. And you started this a couple of years ago with Mopar 10, right? That
exactly.
Was a Challenger.
2010, we realized that despite the most of the performance cars of Chrysler are called Mopars. There wasn't a single car that came out from the production plant with a Mopar bed. So we fixed that gap with the Mopar 10 that was a Challenger, and then the Mopar 11 that was a Charger, and in 2012 with the 75th anniversary, we are going to transform the 300 into a Mopar 12, as usually with a lot of customization, and as usually always with a limited edition, because this is we are still an after-sales brand, so we are not entering into mass production. But every year there will be a car in limited production to celebrate the DNA of the brand.
So why would someone go for a Mopar car rather than an SRT car from Chrysler?
I think you get into two different type of customers, even if they are very, very close. Definitely SRT is all about performance. And you get to a production car, and it's normally, it's always the top model in terms of performance of our brand. But you have, in any case, a sort of more mainstream look. I mean, there is a lot into the car, there is a lot into the engine. When you get to our cars, you get in someone that would like a limited edition of something that is unique, and obviously there is, in most of the cases, the connection with the Mopar brand. We had a lot of discussion, are we going to overlap with SRT, etc. But when I see that both the SRTs and our cars get a lot of attention and above all a lot of orders, because we have been sold out all the previous models in weeks or in some cases even in days, I mean, it means that there is still space for something different. And for instance, our special editions are always black, so that is one limit, for instance.
And performance-wise, though, they do bridge the gap between a 300C and an SRT8, because the engine is not the big honker engine.
Yeah. You are spot on, because that is one of the heritage of Mopar, taking a base model and moving up. So we create this, we cover this space in between a RT level, in the case of, for instance, Dodge, the RT and the SRT. This is starting from the 300S, adding handling, some performance, and a lot of unique accents and customization on the inside. I mean, there are details like, for instance, the shifter is a unique shifter with the Mopar logo that you will find only on this car.
You must have had some great arguments over how to do SRT versus Mopar cars, though. I would have loved to have heard some of them. I'm sure there was pounding on the table and no, you can't, and yes, I can kind of talk.
You would be surprised, but it was not the case. I think that, first of all, you know Ralf Gears.
Yes.
He's leading he is definitely a person, a car guy that gets Mopar. So we work together all the time. The Mopar 10, the original of the Mopar 10 was with a call that I made to my place into Ralf saying, are you okay if we make a special version of the Dodge, if he was leading Dodge at that time with the Mopar bed? I said, oh, it's a wonderful idea. Go ahead. I mean, I like the idea to sort of give even more exposure to the Challenger. So we quickly established that there is a simple between Mopar and forget for a moment the special edition of a car, but SRT is production. We are after sales, with the exception of the special model that we do in limited edition every year. So we cover two different segments.
Do you find that the number of people who are interested in customization is growing, shrinking, staying the same, doing something else?
Is high, it is growing. I mean, with all the limitation in the last 2 years of an industry that was sort of recovering. But that is an interesting element, because if you look at the after-sales business, the only business that is growing, despite a number of headwinds, so better quality of the cars, that is great for the customer, but obviously it means selling less parts. Extended maintenance intervals. I mean, if you look at cars, they are moving from 3,000 miles to 8,000 miles, so that means 64% less oil changes in 5 years. So there are a number of elements that are driving less after-sales business, but there is one driver that instead is growing, that is customization. We actually almost double the number of the dollars of accessory that we sell for every car. And this is a mix between having expanded the portfolio of accessory, but also is the evidence of the interest of the customer for a personalization.
Do you have any figures on the average amount a customer would spend on the car that gets the most? Like, I presume it would be Challengers or something like that, that they customize.
You're right. You've studied pretty well. The Challenger is actually the most accessorized car that we have, and is above $800 per car on the life of a car. We have an average that is around $400, between $400 and $500. Obviously, it's very much related to the mix. The more you sell small cars, and obviously they take less accessories compared to a truck. But you have the Wrangler around $500, $600, the Ram truck, same. And what is interesting, obviously, you work in completely different segments. You know? Trucks is all about side steps, bed liners. And when you get to cars, you go into different environments, either performance or technology. It's actually our best-selling accessory in the last 4 or 5 months is our EVTS system, electronic vehicle tracking system, that is a GPS system that you put on a car that allows you to track your car, to define a geofencing perimeter, to define a speed limit, and then getting a text message if the car is going out or is speeding. That is pretty popular with the parents. I would say less with the teens.
Yeah.
So are the people who are buying the accessories, I mean, do you know whether they're new cars that they're adding things to that they didn't buy from the dealer and then they are remorseful about? Or are these people who have a car that's 2 or 3 years old and they're saying, we really need to make this up to date?
He's hired the first one, so he's hired the sales of accessory when you buy a car. This is... it is also the reason why, for instance, in the rest of the world, in Europe, you sell less accessories. The fact that in the U.S. You buy 90% of the car from the lot means that finding the perfect combination of what you wanted is not necessarily easy, while instead in Europe you have probably 80% of the cars that are ordered, so you can set up your car as you want. So there is a lot that can be done to... customize the car according to the needs of the customer. Then you have what you sell afterwards, especially a particular car is Wrangler. Wrangler is every Wrangler owner is buying almost one accessory every year. It's like this year I'm going to get a lift kit, next year whatever. I mean, a new bumper. Then I put a winch. So this is like building your.
Is it still true that sort of the industry standard is Scion, that those people sell the most stuff? I know when they first came out, it was something over $1,000 per car, I think, some crazy amount, because they had all the light-up footwells and all that crazy junk that, you know, the youth really liked, you know.
I know that they are heavy. I don't know the number. What you can probably find that is, when you have... you don't have a large number of cars, dealers tend to focus more on accessories. For instance, we are selling pretty well accessories for the Fiat 500, and there are two reasons. First of all, that we have a large gamut of accessories, 150 accessories for the Fiat 500. That was already in Europe one of the most customized cars. It was really designed to be ready for customization. But even here, we sell more than $200, $250, and we are growing. Obviously, Fiat dealers are obviously very much engaged to sell accessories to expand the
business. Can those be rolled into the lease or the?
Yeah, in most of the cases, okay. Yes.
I know that's always been a key for selling customization parts or any kind of, specialty parts is baking all that into the financing of the car. And if you can sell it, to the customer on that basis, then it's, maybe a few more dollars a month instead of talking, I got to spend $1,000 more.
You're absolutely right. And we have done something that is key for what we think has been a success in selling accessories. We have next to every production plant an upfit center, so dealers can order cars with accessories on already, and so getting the accessory in the Maroni sticker, and as a consequence, being part of the value of the car.
And so the warranty is...
Yeah, and that has been a key success factor, for instance, on trucks. I mean, most of the dealers are ordering the truck with a bed liner from the plant, from our upfit center or side steps, and is key, both for the financing and secondly to have the accessories into the Maroni stickers in terms of residual value of the car.
Oh, that's a good point.
Oh, absolutely.
For the residual value of the car. I never thought of that.
Yeah.
Because, if it goes to auction, for example, if it's not on the Maroni or built into the VIN, you lost that value at resale. Yeah.
So the fit center, and we have one for every one or two plants. So in some cases they are joined. They are a key element to drive. Because to sell accessories, you need to display the accessory. I mean, you need to show the customer, and normally a customer is going to fall in love with a car. So you need to show the car, say, oh, I want that car. That is because you need to see what is the final effect. And that has been really the game changer with the dealers. We have a dedicated field force that is just talking about accessories with the dealers so that they... And, accessories are in between the parts manager, the sales manager, the service manager that has to install them, and the F&I that has to find them. So you need to work that process inside the dealer. Well, we have dealerships that are selling an average of $1,000 of accessories per car. So it's showing that, it can be done if you follow the right process.
So how does it work? I want to buy a Mopar vehicle. Here you've got a Mopar 12, which is a Chrysler. The Mopar 10 was a Dodge Challenger. At the Dream Cruise last year, you showed a Jeep pickup conversion that you
got
too.
Oh, that was
our
conversion.
So how does I just go to one of those brands, Jeep, Dodge, or Chrysler, and say, I want to see what you got for Mopar.
Yeah, you have, unless you're looking for the limited edition of one of our cars. So if it is a Mopar 10, I'm sorry. You need to find someone ready to sell the car.
Because you only built a certain number, and that's it.
We were 500 units were sold in... This was when we launched that car. We had a lot of headaches. Now it's gonna. We were confident, but it was the first one coming out, and so you may remember we had a sort of a webcast press conference, and we had decided to build 500 units. We got in excess of 1,000 orders in a few days. And most of the orders were already, orders with a customer that has called the dealer and say, I want the car. So we did, for the Mopar 11, there are still some cars available in some dealerships, so I can put a good word for you if you're interested. and sometimes it's funny. We call the dealer. We say, I see that you have still a Mopar 11. Is it a problem? No, I'm keeping the car as a way to show the customers how they can customize a car, etc. So, and this one will be a 500 limited edition. So starting from the summer, you just go into a dealer and you can order the car. Instead, if you want to go towards a transformation kit of accessories, you go to a dealer with your car, you ask for the catalog of the accessories, or you can obviously look on the web on mobile.com and looking at what are the accessories available. Mobile.com or Dodge.com if it is a Dodge. I mean, we are all we have all the websites connected. You select your accessories and you go to the dealer, and the dealer, they can either, or if you don't have a car, order a car already with the accessories or installing the accessories on your car.
I don't suppose you have any data yet on Mopar 10s that may have changed hands, and are they far outpacing the resale value?
Very few so far, yeah. Very few. And actually, we have customers that bought the Mopar 10 and then the Mopar 11. They want the same serial number.
Oh, geez.
It's also an experience. The reason why we do this is not only selling a car, but selling an experience. So all these cars are coming with an owner's kit. By chance, I have here.
Just by chance. You happen to have one right next to you, yes.
So is that it?
You have this nice sort of brushed aluminum suitcase that it all comes
in. I'm opening it on the right side, yes. So for every car, you get also a kit. There is what we call a Mopar ambassador or advocate in every business center across the U.S. that is should give delivery. The problem is that time customers are very, they hurry up to get the car and drive away. But every customer gets a kit. Forget for a moment a letter from myself in this case, Saad Chbab, the head of Chrysler. Then you get a little of the car that is the original sketch made by the designer, Mark Trossel, that is the Mopar design that is starting from a production car, deciding what is the accent and what are the elements, and that is normally very appreciated. Then there is a sort of brochure about the story of the car. So you have why you have that rims, why you have the interior, etc. You have a copy of the Maroni sticker in metal that is gonna stay with you and you can display. And we are going to deliver the car with a paper holder with the Mopar, the 75th anniversary logo that you can display on your desk. And every owner kit is different. There is also a pen that I was missing. And there is a Mopar pen with the logo of the 75th anniversary. So you have always this experience getting not only a car but something. And every kit will be personalized with the number, the serial number of the car. It is a way to create an experience. And I called sometime when I'm able to connect with a customer while he's taking delivery of the car, I call asking if he's happy, etc. And normally you see really the idea that, I mean, we care, right? And the delivery of a car is the most important moment into the purchase experience, because it's the moment when you sort of close the loop. You know, you always get out, after having bought a car, you always get out with the idea, was it the best possible deal? I mean, is there something else? So it's the moment where you need really to make the customer happy and sort of the hero going out with the car, etc. And this is true everywhere in the world. It's one of the few things that really is not different everywhere, from India, where they give you flowers, someone is benedicting the car, and they make really a ceremony, to the U.S., where, or in Italy, where often you go with the family to take delivery of the car.
I love that. I think that's a very clever approach of giving a very high-touch personal experience in something as simple as a very nicely done sort of owner's kit. Mm-hmm. Because these days, you know, usually if you pick up a new car, you get the keys, you're told it's out in the lot, and that's it.
It shouldn't be like that. Obviously, above all when the industry is at good level, obviously we are all happy to have a lot of customers in our showrooms buying cars, etc. But then you risk to lose that moment that is absolutely important. Not only explaining the features of the car, but also showing the value of what the customer has bought. And features are very important. You were talking earlier about the technology. I mean, we put a lot of technology into cars, and then you may have customers that after 1 year, they discover that there is a feature that they didn't know because it was not explained at the delivery of the car. No, and even if the customer is in a hurry, I mean, you should need. Okay, would you like to come back? Can I come to see you? This is why, for instance, we launched the smartphone applications. We were the first one to put all the owner's manuals into a smartphone application that you can download free of charge, both for iPad or iPhone or Android. And so you can really access quickly all the features of the car without having to look up at a bulky manual. And by the way, we saved also, I guess, 10,000 trees per year of bulky manual. That is a nice byproduct.
Yeah, yeah.
But the delivery is absolutely important.
Mm-hmm. Hey, look, we've got to take another commercial break, and then we got to get into the audience questions for Rapid Fire. So, Ben, why don't we give a shout-out to our good friends at Chevrolet, who sponsors the show.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh, no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
Okay, this is the part of the show where we get to the audience questions. And, Ben, let's get it started. Okay, first question comes from formerly Baja Busta, who asks, will I be able to get a Mopar Abarth?
Huh. This is a very interesting, very good question. I don't think you will get a Mopar Abarth because Abarth is already a tuning brand of performance. What is sure that Mopar and Abarth are collaborating to offer performance for the Fiat 500 and the next Fiats that will come. So we are actively, the two teams are working together. We are actually sharing, components. So there will be a bit of Mopar in Abarth and a bit of Abarth in Mopar.
Okay. Alan wants to know, many of Mopar's performance and restoration parts for 60s and 70s era muscle cars are being phased out as NS1 in the dealer ordering system. Are you getting out of supporting older Mopar muscle cars? Don't you like their DNA?
No, absolutely not. And by the way, I suggest who is writing to contact us at either at Mopar.com or my mail address. This is pietro.gorlier@chrysler.com. So I'm open 24/7 to receive. We may have this.
You'll get a bunch of calls on that.
I'm already getting. I'm in charge of customer care for Chrysler, so I always. They make the point of reading all the
letters.
So
pietro.gorlier at mopar.com?
Or at chrysler.com.
Okay.
And so we may have discontinued something either for lack of orders or in some cases also for lack of material and lack of tools. So we need to remember also that in 2009, Chrysler went through a restructuring process.
Okay, Roman Koch's got a question here. He says, parts, sure, but why sell Mopar-branded products?
It's a tribute to the history of Mopar, period. I mean, we are not becoming an SRT-like brand or something, but it's a tribute that every year we tribute to the history of Mopar and to those that are connected with Mopar.
Okay, Gary, I think this one's for you since you were talking about the Flex. JF in Quebec says, I watched Autoline Daily today, nearly $50,000 for a loaded Ford Flex. Would it make sense to move it to the Lincoln brand? He says any car that costs more than 40 grand needs some prestige branding associated with it.
Well, let's not forget about the Lincoln MKT, which is on the Flex platform, so they basically have one. And, you know, another thing is that, I mean, if you look at that car, I mean, there's a whole lot of real estate in that thing.
It's big.
Okay, it's big. I mean, and so for the amount of money that you're spending, I mean, you're getting a whole lot of stuff. I mean, it's like a living room. I mean, you know, just
and that sure ain't the only $50,000-plus way to spend money in a Ford dealer.
Sure.
Right.
You can go for a King Ranch Edition F-150.
Oh, a lot of trucks can get up there. Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, and they only have two rows, maybe.
Yeah.
Not three.
I find the Flex interesting because, according to Ford, and I believe them on this, they're attracting a customer who would never otherwise buy a Ford. And they tend to do well in California, where Ford tends not to do well.
And so even highest retention rate of any car, they claim. So people have one
of any Ford.
Yeah, it's their highest retention rate product in Ford. So
I still say riding in the middle row seat is one of the most comfortable, nice riding experiences in any car out there today. I think they've done a pretty good job on that. Tim wants to know, what does everybody think of the 2018 Commodore, Citroen C5, and Peugeot 508 all moving to the Epsilon platform? What do you think, Frank?
Hey, why not? I mean, suddenly it's, you remember the Alpha 164 Saab 9000 Lancia Tema? It's the same kind of deal. They differentiated those products pretty well. Maybe they can do the same here again.
Of course, speaking of Saab, look how well the Epsilon platform worked out for it.
That might not have been the only causal factor there.
Okay, back to you, Pietro. Jim says, I work as a mechanic, and I must say I see the aftermarket world for parts as a very, very tough one. How do you really think you will launch a brand and make it work? Well, the brand's been launched. It's been around for 75 years, right? But it's a tough business, he says.
No, it's definitely a tough business. As I said, also from one side, cars are becoming more complicated and with a lot of technologies also in terms of training and skills to take care of a car. You need to have the proper level of skills into a dealership. A lot of competition. I mean, the number of independents that are in the market is huge. I mean,
a lot of offshore knockoff crap too, right?
I normally tell our dealers when I mean we launched this very strong program to engage them into express service and Saturday hours, extended hours. That is sort of a no-brainer, but in the U.S. where everything is 24/7 and you have a drive-through of everything. I mean, there are 37 independent around every one of our dealers as average. So that means that in some cases there are 100, et cetera. They offer convenience, so we need as a official network to offer the same kind of level. Customers are making a choice that is mainly based on convenience. So they want to get a good service, well done, the right price, executed well the first time. It's even more important than the price itself, to be sure that you get in. If you have to make a maintenance, in 50, 20 minutes, you're out. So if you offer that kind of service to the customer will come, and obviously decide it is a relatively profitable business part and service.
Frank, I'm going to throw this one to you. Ducati, Audi. Great for VW Group's image, but financially a bad move. Ducati has debt. It's Italian. See Fiat. Any thoughts?
Well,
that's from Victor.
Audi is already seeing Lamborghini, so they know something about, you know, working with Italians, and they've made that work incredibly well. So, of course, to me, one of the more interesting things of that whole deal was that Audi has the autonomy to go do that. I mean, they're part of Volkswagen AG, but Audi on its own can go do this tie-in. And of course, Audi, you know, they had those bike brands back in the good old days. Maybe that's why they wanted to do it.
How is the motorcycle market? I mean, is that a market that, I mean, obviously Ducati's got some real strong.
It's closely held, as they say, so we don't know any of their financials. But it's probably good. You know, Peter DeLorenzo made a good point last week here. He says, you know, this is another way of Audi going after BMW,
sure,
which is very successful in motorcycles. So if BMW's got bikes, we're going to have bikes too, is the thinking of why Audi has gone and bought Ducati. I find it fascinating, but I think you raise a really good point there, Frank, is Audi having the autonomy to go out and do this. I'm just still blown away by the way Volkswagen Group approaches running the business.
I wouldn't be surprised if somebody at Audi, you know, picked up the horn to Mr. Piek, but...
Hey, we got a phone call in here. Ben, let's bring that in.
Yes, I have a question for the man at Mopar. How does he feel that there's really a market between a 300C Limited, Mopar, and then the SRT8? It seems to me that there's little to no market for the car for some trim additions. Unfortunately, this is what caused the downfall of car companies with too many trim levels. Louis Frank, Bethpage, New York. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that, Frank. So we talked a little bit about this.
Yeah, and obviously it's a good point, a respectable point. On the other hand, we see that we sell a lot of customization on the 300, even starting from the 300S. If you think we have 7 different grills for the 6 different rims, and we see that we are selling constantly accessories on people buying 300 and wanting to move the car a step up without getting to the SRT, that is a different world in terms of performance, in terms of handling, etc. So you have people that want a unique car, sort of. So there is a space, and we may, it's probably true, we may take not an additional customer, but moving a customer from a 300S upwards. But at the end, I mean, it's fine. I mean, it's giving them the possibility to have a unique car. And the fact that we keep the car to a limited edition of 500 units is the best answer. We don't want to sort of starting creating a too crowded market.
You already talked about the 500, but Goggles Pisano wants to know, there's a Challenger drag pack. Will there be a Mopar-branded package for the 500 for the upcoming B-Spec racing formula?
Well, stay tuned, I will say.
Oh, good question.
Definitely the Fiat 500 is a car that is racing already in Europe. So there is a lot of interest now that we have the Abarth. So I think stay tuned. I'm sure you will see Fiat 500 racing.
Okay, Goat Rope says, many of the car magazines and blogs test cars loaded with options. It's not unusual to see vehicles' price jump 30% just due to the options. And I'll throw it to you two guys here. What's your favorite no-options stripper? He says, I happen to like the VW GTI without the bells and whistles.
That's a good one. With the cloth seats, can you still get those? I mean, a couple years ago you could. That was the way to have that car. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Although I'd kind of want the DSG. For a long time, the hot one was a base 3 Series with nothing on it. But they're impossible to order. Most of the dealers just look at you and say, no, we don't order them that way because
we'll
make more money on them.
Eventually.
Yeah. Never. The local ones here would just say no. Mm-hmm. But those were great, too, because of terrific value. And vinyl seats looked like leather. Well, what the heck, you know?
But, I mean, it's so hard to say because, I mean, as he correctly points out, I mean, the ones we get are all loaded up, right?
Yeah.
So, it's exceedingly hard.
For a non-enthusiast car, I actually liked the super base Nissan Versa. Yeah, no, I'm telling you why.
The new one? The sedan?
With the roll-up crank windows. And, I mean, it's because if you start to put anything on that car, look, it's like 10, 11 grand base price.
It's 11,995
okay,
or something. Whatever,
it'd
be under 12.
I think it's the cheapest car that you can buy in the U.S. market. But when you start putting things on, it's like, no, this is a cheap car. So I actually...
That's a miserable
Frank
car.
Frank is cringing.
No, that's a miserable car. Any 2-year-old car with stuff on it is better than that one.
Yeah. So wouldn't that be called a Datsun in other parts of the world now?
Yeah. It's going to be. That's right. Here's one from Gideon in Frankfurt, Germany, saying, he says, just an idea, let the GTC, the Opel GTC, if you guys are familiar with that, kind of a... two-door sports car. I think it's a hard-top convertible. It says, let that go to the U.S. market, like with the Manta and the Opel GT in the 60s and 70s. What do you think?
What would the price point be? That's
a good point.
The tricky thing. I doubt you're going to be able to bring that thing in here and sell it for the price of the G6 hardtop convertible, which was, I think, about the same size. Mm-hmm. You know, and that thing didn't light the world on fire. And if this would be, again, a lot more.
That's a good point. You know, it's very difficult to build cars in euros and sell them in the U.S. Unless they're very premium cars and you can bake in the
currency. You're probably going to sell them as a Buick, and then it's kind of a funny fit for Buick. I mean, I don't know that they're getting a ton of traction on the super high zoot, you know, ones they got right now. So I'm not seeing it.
Can you bake parts in the U.S. and sell them in Europe, Mopar parts?
And there are parts. We have now Mopar with this globalization of Mopar where we overview the after sales for both Fiat and Chrysler. We have development centers both in Europe, obviously here in North America and in Asia Pacific. And in some cases, we develop parts for globally. There are some parts that are linked to regulations. Mm-hmm. The main limit is that if you enter in something that is connected with a specific regulation. That is actually, I mean, probably the problem of the platform. Either you design since the beginning a platform to be good for both Europe and North America, accepting additional costs probably at the beginning, or vice versa, or then you get into troubles with the cost for federalization. I mean, so. Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's an interesting question from A.M. Guerrero, who says, when the run of 500 units is over, can you build a similar 300? In other words, could I go and get all the parts and accessories and build my own Mopar 12 based on the Chrysler 300?
Technically, yes, with a couple of exceptions that are obviously the dedicated elements, the unique elements like the serial number and the logo. And the shifter by now is only for this car. Maybe in future we will put into the market. But normally we try to keep elements that will remain only for that car. There is, for instance, in this car, there is a splash screen when you open the infotainment unit that is showing the Mopar logo set. So you can get relatively close.
So you could buy the wheels and
be able to buy the wheel, not with this accent, this blue accent.
The pinstriper will have to get after it.
The pinstripes, you need to get a good painter. But you can get normally pretty close. Not exactly there.
Well, you don't want it to be exact. You don't want this to be special.
You don't get the owner kit. Okay. The
get that on eBay.
Well, it's interesting. We have, for the respect that we have for the customers, for instance, during the previous run, I had a customer asking, say, can I have the kit without my name on? Say, no, you get the kit. If you buy the car, you get the kit with your name. You know, obviously, someone was willing to sell the car. Mm-hmm. So. But then there are other great stories of people say, can you put the name of my wife? Can I have the same serial number of the Mopar 10 with the 11? So there are a number of stories that we are building.
Can you do that? Can you give them the VIN that they want?
If they get...
it hasn't been built already.
In time, and the car has not been bought already from another customer, we try to keep. Normally, they call even before we start the run of production. And it's interesting because then we connect with the customers. Now we have these about 2,000 customers of the previous run, so including also the drag pack that was an 80 units limited edition. And so we connect with them. We send material, posters. Every year we try to create this kind of connection.
That's great. Pietro, we got to wrap it up here, but it's been great having you come in.
Thank you. This is
fascinating. I don't know anybody else in the business really approaching this after sales and customization quite like you guys are.
Mopar is a great value and is absolutely unique. If you visit an auto show, it's the only after sales brand that you find on the main floor next to the production models. And we are part, and also to go back to one of the questions, we are part of the show because we try to add value to the other brands, not to overlap. So we have a car in every stand. So a Jeep that is customized, Chrysler is customized, a Dodge. We are starting working with the Dart. I mean, that is a perfect canvas for customization, because we want to add value. We want to give customers an additional reason to buy our cars. On top of that, then we want to take care of them in the service. That is equally important.
Well, great. Thanks for coming in and talking all about that with us. And got to thank Frank Marcus at Motor Trend Magazine, Gary Vasilash, Automotive Design and Production. Great having the both of you here.
Thank you, John.
Always a delight.
And I want to remind everybody, it looks like all the more that we're going to be at the New York Auto Show, and we'll probably be doing AutoLine After Hours from Katz's Deli. So if you're in the city and you're going to be, might be interested in stopping by and watching us do AutoLine After Hours from Katz's, drop us a line. Let us know about it, because that could be pretty cool. And don't forget, you can get the podcast of the show at the iTunes store tomorrow. Just look for AutoLine. It's free, and you can get it all there. And can get all of Frank's stuff at, what, motortrend.com, right?
That's right.
Gary, automotive design and production.com.
It's autofieldguide.com.
Autofieldguide, that's right, which is the parent publisher on that. And then Pietro, mopar.com, right? Just go there and get everything. Good. Okay, good night, everybody. Thanks for listening. And I will not be here next week, but the auto extremist will be in charge. Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet, Chevy runs deep.